Now, this paper is entitled History as It Is Lived, an Anthropological Perspective on Autonomy, Contingency, and Historical Necessity. It is generally accepted in principle that history explains everything about us human beings. Problem is that history seems difficult to arrive at, even once we have conceptualized it. I begin, however, with how we think about history, because what I'm discussing here is not history as something external to us, confined to the past, or history as it is known or generally understood, or history as it is written, or the personal history we can recollect and tell to others, but rather history as it is lived. And about how an understanding of history as lived enables us to think about our, in all respects, material selves as emergent, autopoietic, self-creating, self-producing products of a past that from moment to moment evinces itself in the present in every aspect of our being, and that is even now giving rise to a future we cannot surely predict, even for ourselves as particular persons. What is difficult to realize and to remain conscious of is the fact that we are our history, that from moment to moment, in literally every aspect of our being, we at once manifest our history and live its all-pervasive presence. Our history is not merely a part of us. It is the whole of us. We are constituted by the history that informs our entire being, from conception, throughout gestation in the womb, from our birth onwards, throughout all our lives, to the very moment of our death. This history that continues to give rise to each of us in all our uniqueness is, at its most general, a material history of social relations that have transformed and continue to transform over the millennia that produced us as contemporary human beings in all our dynamic complexity. Our particular personal genetic profile is one dimension of this social history and cannot properly be understood in isolation from it. This much I hope we can agree on. The problem is that even when we agree that all humans, including ourselves, are historical products, and that we are bound to manifest our historicity, we come up against questions concerning autonomy, contingency, and historical necessity. Take this moment, for example. Each one of us is aware of ourselves, our physicality, our sense of our situatedness in this particular space-time, our thoughts and feelings, which are at once vividly present and constantly escaping us. By and large, we humans are very aware of ourselves as particular human beings, aware of our autonomy, cherishing it, and at the same time looking to make connections with others that might breach the existential loneliness that is its counterpart. No doubt, as anthropologists, a good number of you, perhaps the majority, are already questioning my generalizations here. Are all humans indeed aware of their autonomy? Do we all experience existential loneliness? Are we all looking to make connections with others? I would say these generalizations are all warranted by ethnography, though of course we may wish to argue over the details. After all, this is our job as anthropologists, to find out the particularities of particular ethnographic cases and, insofar as we generalize, to do so with care, mindful always of the fact that while indigenous Fijians, for example, have much in common, there is a great deal to differentiate those who come from the Lau Islands from those who come from Vanua Levu or the Isawas or Lomé Viti. And within the area of Lomé Viti, each island population may be easily differentiated from the next, and within island, one chiefly confederation from another, and within chiefly confederation, one village from another, within village, one group of clans from another, within clan, one subclan from another, and within subclan, one household from another, and within household, one particular person from another particular person. We know well enough that each person is particular, unique, from which it follows that his or her ideas and practices are bound too to be uniquely his or hers, differentiated from the next person's. We know about and acknowledge this uniqueness of each and every human being, but we do not usually dwell on it, in large part because in our efforts after explanation, we tend to bring to the fore what the people whose lives we are researching have in common, and how these very commonalities are what enable us to analyze the collective dimension of human histories as they are evinced in the present. The problem is, of course, that when we do this, we are likely to be accused of misleading generalization, or worse, stereotyping. This problem does not go away. It dogs our analytical footsteps every step of the way, much as if we have constantly to remind our listeners or readers or interlocutors by means of the specificity of our ethnographies that we have no intention of denying the uniqueness of any person. This uniqueness is inevitable, of course, a function of the autonomy given by the autopoiesis that characterizes living things, including humans. Autopoiesis, self-creation, self-regulation, necessarily entails autonomy. This autonomy means that our own particular lived history differentiates itself from the lived histories even of those closest to us, our siblings, our spouses, our children. Even so, insofar as we share a history, on occasion we are able spontaneously to understand and respond as one, even to situations that are unprecedented. Let me give an example. Early in September 1981, 5 months into my first Fijian fieldwork in the chiefdom of Soeke on the island of Ngao, Loma Viti, some people from Nawaikama village were reported lost at sea. A search by plane was in progress. That night I went with others to drink yangona, ground kava root infused in water, at the house of a woman whose brother was among the lost. She wept and covered her face while we drank and talked and sometimes laughed, and when the yangona was a mother, dry, the large bowl empty, she asked her husband to losetale, mix another, so that we might stay and not leave her alone with her thoughts. 3 days later, the search by planes having been called off and the people in the boat given up for dead, I went with Soeke villagers to Nawaikama for Narengu Rengu, the kissing ceremonies for the dead. So many having been lost, 5 persons from a single small village, we were obliged to proceed from one house of mourning to another, in each of which the women wailed and wept with their bereaved kin, and the men presented whale's teeth and food. We spent all day drinking yangona in the different houses and eating well, for a cow as well as some pigs had been slaughtered to feed the mourners, and in the evening we went home. The mourning ceremonies continued for 4 nights, with further ceremonies on the 10th night, and no doubt there would have been an elaborate observance of the 100th night had those who were lost not been found. They were rescued in the Solomon Islands, their small boat, its engine out of commission, having been carried across the Pacific for 45 days. They were nothing but skin and bone and dehydrated and sick, but they were alive. And some weeks later, they returned home to Nawaikama. A Fijian woman friend who accompanied the survivors on their return to the village from the capital told me about the ceremonies of welcome in Nawaikama. This is an extract from Field Notes from October 1981. Tyner says, when they arrived from the airfield and looked out of the minibus, the people were sitting on the ground, their heads sunk upon their chests. The Vakasombu was performed, a presentation of whale's teeth to those returning before they set foot upon the earth. Everyone was crying. Then the returnees were taken to the stone erected in their memory, now buried in lengths of cloth that were presented to them for the ceremony of Vapamamatha, making dry. Italatala, the Methodist minister, performed a thanksgiving. Then to the village hall for Sevu Sevu, the presentation of Yangona root that begs the chief's acknowledgement, and Rengu Rengu, presentation of whale's teeth for those who died during one's absence. Then one of the chiefs said that everything had been done that had to be done, and all differences between them should be forgotten. People should be happy. And they all gave three cheers, and then it was Ngiri Lali, beating drums, and Ngiri Kava, beating tins, all round the village, and Munyangona, Kava drinking. The celebrations had begun. This account is not given in my friend's own words, and it leaves out the awed tones of her voice and how I asked her to tell me again. What happened at the beginning? The people were sitting on the ground with their heads sunk upon their chests. Why weren't they happy? She said, Christina, erasa mandua, mandua sarana uirgede. They were ashamed. All of them were really very ashamed. And you couldn't hear a sound, she said, for the whole village was quiet, and all of them were just sitting there on the ground, ashamed. My friend's account impressed and puzzled me. She herself had been impressed by the people's shame, but for her it required no explanation, and in telling me of it, she conveyed that shame was the only proper, the only conceivable, natural response to this unique event in which those who had been given up for dead had returned to their kin to live again. But I was puzzled. This was indeed an event for which there were no exemplars, and yet, with one accord, all the villagers evinced shame in the face of their miraculously rescued kin. From my perspective today, some 30 years on, I can see villagers' ashamed response as an apparently non-linear eruption of the past into the present. Non-linear because the occasion was unprecedented, and an eruption that is possible precisely because history is what we live. I have to begin by acknowledging again that my account above is second hand, though corroborated anecdotally by others present who were themselves among those seated on the ground. It is important to note, too, that I do not mean to suggest that because the villagers showed shame, they were all of them actually feeling ashamed. What they were actually feeling may be irrelevant so far as my purposes here are concerned. What is important is that, apparently with one accord, the villagers welcomed their returning kin with bowed head and downcast gaze, the behavioural attitude that signifies shame. I have to emphasise here that this is not the usual way of greeting one who returns to the village, even after a long absence. The question of how one comes to respond appropriately to a unique situation is related to the more general question and how it is that we respond appropriately to situations whose like we have experienced before. The obvious answer is that we already have an understanding formed out of our previous experience, and elsewhere I have described the process through which a Fijian child may constitute an idea of self and of relations with others in terms of constellation of feelings in which shame, or in its mildest form, embarrassment, is the counterpart of anger. That is to say, where anger can have no object but the self, shame is its artifact. The Fijian example confirms what many another ethnographer has found before me, that feelings, which seem to be so personal and private, are constituted in such a way as to implicate the broad domain of social organization. Our feelings about ourselves and the peopled world situate us in relation to those others alongside whom we live our lives, and, in so doing, simultaneously inform our sense of self. So any Fijian person's ideas and feelings of shame are at any given point informing his or her sense of self, relations with others, general comportment, and ability to behave correctly in situations he or she has not previously encountered. But let me return briefly to my previous paper concerning shame and its significance. The Fijian idea of the person as a locus of relationship is evinced in recognition of particular forms of relations with others and the obligations they entail. As a Fijian adult, you distinguish yourself by demonstrating who you are as a function of what you are given to be in relations with others. What you are given to be derives from an interaction between kinship relation, relative rank, chief or commoner, seniority, older or younger, and gender, where the focal relationship is that of wife or sister in respect of a given man. Kinship, vewekani, is conceived of, spoken of, and lived in terms of velomani, mutual love or compassion, and vekawaitaki, caring for one another, mutual concern. The term for my kin, wekangu, may include all ethnic Fijians, and kinship terms are used in reference and address. With the exception of cross cousins, who are equals and compete with one another, all kinship relations are hierarchical. Mutual compassionate love and concern for one another characterize all kinship relations, hierarchical or equal, but mandua, usually translated as shame, is a crucial existential aspect of hierarchy. Mandua refers to a range of feelings that arise from other people's blame or praise of one's actions. At one extreme, a deep and abiding shame, and at the other, shyness or embarrassment. It is always a function of the dynamics of relationships. Mandua is manifested in face, body posture, and actions. One hangs one's head, drops one's chin to one's chest, avoids eye contact, one's shoulders and body droop, one does not speak, and if profoundly mandua, one flees the company of others. An adult is especially mandua when his or her behavior is brought into disrepute. This is to be ashamed of oneself, but one may be shamed too by others' behavior. A younger brother's drunken violence, a son's laziness and neglect of duty, a younger sister's illegitimate pregnancy, the daughter's involvement with a married man. Elders collectively may be shamed by drunken behavior in young men. A paramount chief or clan chiefs may be shamed by their people's poor showing in some community endeavor. In these collective relations, the paramount or the clan chiefs may induce shame in their people by publicly berating them. In dyadic adult relations within sex, shame gives rise to an angry and or sorrowful lecture from the senior person that is intended to induce shame in the junior. But where a man feels shamed by a woman's behavior, he may resort to physical punishment. A husband may beat his wife for dancing, a brother may beat a younger sister for failing in some duty to senior kin, a father may beat his daughter for sexual promiscuity, and so on. In all cases, shame and anger are aspects of the same experience. This is most clearly seen when the anger can be directed by the person who is shamed, a father, say, towards the one who has done the shameful thing, say, a promiscuous daughter, who is then shamed by being punished for what she has done. For her, the anger that is an aspect of shame can have no object but the self. Note that in all the examples I have given, the senior party rebukes or punishes the junior. If a junior person were to lecture or beat his or her senior, this would itself be a cause for shame and require the junior person ceremonially to ask forgiveness by presenting Yangon a root or a whale's tooth, followed by the drinking of Yangona. By contrast, mandua has no acknowledged place in relations between cross cousins, who by definition compete as equals. So at public gatherings, cross cousins, both within and cross sex, may tease each other unmercifully. To evince mandua in such a case is to be outdone. In short, mandua is at once expressive and constitutive of hierarchical relations. Elsewhere, I have shown how Fijian village children constitute over time an idea of hierarchy as a principle of social organization by reference to people's disposition vis-à-vis one another in the ritualized spaces, the house, the church, the community hall, and the village itself. An above-below axis is applied to the floor space of these buildings. It refers to a single plane where one pole is called above and the opposite pole is below. Whenever people gather to eat, worship, drink kava, or discuss village affairs, differential status is always apparent. Their relative positions accord with an interaction between rank, seniority, and gender that describes hierarchical relations between kin. Above below is a spatial corollary of the tributary relationship between people and chiefs, which is found in Yangona ritual, and which appears to contain, and thus to render non-threatening, equally powerful ideas of equality across households. Mandua is, as I noted above, a function of hierarchical relations. A Fijian child who grows up in a rural chiefdom such as Saweyeki Vanua on the island of Ngao, in the course of making sense of conditions in the world created for them by adults, is bound to constitute an idea of hierarchy as principle. An aspect of this process is the child's emergent consciousness of its own physical being in relation to others, a consciousness that underlies a developmental shift that produces deliberate imitation of certain adult behaviors. Until the age of 12 or so, a child is usually literally below, that is, smaller than, those to whom it is subordinate. Even so, a child of 4 who has begun to imitate the politeness behavior of adults makes itself even smaller by walking lolo, its body bent over in the posture of respect that is proper as one moves among others who are seated. But the posture of a child who is somewhat older, 5 to 7, is likely to show a marked and exaggerated shift into respect when the child has to approach and address an adult. The child will bend right over in walking, or crouch down or walk on its knees, making itself as small as possible. 4- and 5-year-old children are already being sent on errands from house to house, so by age 6, the requirement to adopt this posture is frequent. Moreover, by this age, the child is discriminating among adults, such that married men and women and elders are accorded a more exaggerated bodily deference than are young men and women. Any want of politeness is likely to bring forth a sharp rebuke, if not a blow. The shift from imitation of others, it is found in 3- and 4-year-olds, to the deliberate and exaggerated bodily respect that is routine in 5- and 6-year-olds, is not the product of an enlightened understanding of differential status, as this is manifested on the above-below axis that describes any space in which people are gathered. Rather, it is at once an acknowledgement and a manifestation of mandua, a shyness compounded by fear. A Fijian baby and young child is yalu wai. That is to say, both its capacity for reason and its disposition, yalu, are unfixed like water, wai. So there is no point in engaging a child in a conversation or explaining anything to it. Nevertheless, the child is early orientated towards others and made aware of their preeminence. Any explicit teaching of a child is largely directed towards its obligations to others. A baby or infant who is seated on an older person's lap faces outwards towards the company. And if adults address toddlers and children, up to the age of 4 or so, it is usually to tell them to do or not to do certain things. That an action is forbidden, satambu, and that the child must sit down, ndamera, and be quiet, tikolo, other remarks most commonly addressed by adults to toddlers and children up to age 3 or so. By this age, disobedience routinely meets with a smart slap or a sharp knock with the knuckles on the side of the head, and if the child cries or becomes angry, it is ridiculed or the punishment repeated until the crying or display of anger stops. Laughter, ridicule, and mock threats are the common response to any childish distress, even if the child is simultaneously being comforted by mother, say, and are likely to come from anyone and everyone present who is senior to the child by several years. A child of 7 or 8 is in loco parentis to younger children of 3 and 4 and to toddlers. The shame and fear manifested in a child's inability to speak up in response to questions or in a timid and shrinking posture are invariably commented on loudly in the child's hearing. For example, Raila sa rere koya, or Murenda mandua namonengo, look, he's afraid, or this child is always shy. Also, it is common for older children or young men deliberately to anger a child by pinching or teasing it, and then to laugh and mock at the futility of its angry response until the child begins to cry or creeps away, pursued by laughter and joking remarks on its behavior. The meaning a child makes of this experience bears on its relation to others. But in taking the other's point of view, the child also comes to be aware of its own status relative to those others. The experience of being rendered mandua, here meaning shy, through fear, constitutes the child's bodily submission to others, and anger is its inevitable accompaniment. But whether that anger can be directed at others or only at the self constitutes one's status in relation to others. One can direct anger only towards those of lesser status than oneself. Thus, what we might designate as merely emotions may have profound implications for social organization. The process of learning what it is to be mandua is a visceral experience, one that produces a form of felt knowledge, long before that knowledge can be made explicit as a failure to meet one's obligations to kin. When, later on, the child arrives at a mature grasp of the fine distinctions of differential status, this explicit understanding has been informed by and will always be dependent on that visceral knowledge that is mandua. The developing child constitutes its ideas of person and self in tandem with its ideas of relations with others. These correlated ideas are crucial to the entire scope of daily life in respect of kinship, political economy, religion. The foregoing brief ethnography shows that for these Fijian villagers, mandua, shame, implicates an idea of the person as the locus of relations with kin and an idea of hierarchy as a principle of social organization. My 1986 PhD thesis was a social analysis of the political economy of a small Fijian chiefdom centered on the village of Saweyeki Ngao. It provided a social analysis of the constitution of Fijian hierarchy as it has lived in everyday relations between people and evinced in ritual and ritualized behavior. At the same time, it analyzed how people, and here the focus was on children aged between 5 and 14, constituted over time a cognitive scheme which ultimately at once determined a self-evidence, an idea that status is inherent in the person rather than conferred by others, and provided for fine judgments of differential status. The concluding chapter of the thesis was entitled Cognition as a Microhistorical Process, my intention being to convey the idea that an investigation of how people constitute over time the ideas and practices in whose terms they live and talk about their lives is profoundly revealing from an anthropological perspective. This is because the learning process at once maintains and transforms its objects. That is to say, the practices and ideas on which it bears, and is thus itself historical and revealing of the social minutiae of history as it comes down to us and as it is lived in the present. The problem is, however, that to understand this micro-historical process of the constitution of ideas requires at once a social analysis and an analysis of the learning process, one that recognizes that no one of its dimensions can be immune from history. To take the most fundamental, our very perceptions, our seeing, hearing, feeling, are imbued with the history of social relations that have informed our being from conception onwards. What I see is not what you see. What I hear and feel is not what you hear and feel. Even so, we can point things out to one another and agree that we have our perceptions in common. The anthropological project, as I understand it, is to demonstrate and explain the collective dimension of these processes, including perception. That is to say, how it comes to be the case, for example, that a Fijian person's understanding of shame is at once superficially available to me, in that I can recognize it, and utterly unavailable to me, in that I cannot feel it, or even in certain cases, such as the one I describe here, understand it without real analytical effort. This understanding is not a matter of empathy, its presence or absence. It is a matter of understanding the fullness and subtlety of the social relations that imbue perceptions and feelings, speaking and hearing, in short, all imagination, and thus all ideas of the world, whether they be explicit or implicit. In the case I have described here, the specific ceremonies of welcome performed for the returned villagers were those prescribed for a high-ranking visiting or returning chief. That status was, as it were, accorded to the returnees because, having been given up for dead, having been in effect buried with all proper rites, mourned and memorialized, they came back. That in this case the ceremonies be particularly solemn was entirely predictable, as were the villagers' tears, of course, and their shame. From a Fijian perspective, every death is a sacrifice, and in giving their lost kin up for dead, villagers had in so doing effectively sacrificed them, along with the whale's teeth and bark cloth and mats and feast food that were presented by mourners at the funeral ceremonies I described briefly at the beginning. It was widely held that the returnees were rescued by virtue of their own faith in the Christian God, for we were told by one of the two rescued women that they had sung hymns day after day in the tiny cabin of that drifting boat, and day after day they had all five of them prayed. Perhaps, too, it was intimated, they were saved by the intercession of the ancestral gods, for there were many days during that terrible journey that their little boat was escorted by sharks who swam alongside it, the shark being the form taken by the god Nakuwanga, who is the ancestral god of the Akondrovi people, with whom all of the people of Ngao Island are related as Tauvu, a term that denotes a common ancestral chiefly kinship. The shark escort was especially significant, for in the old days, those who fell from a boat or whose boat capsized were understood to be taken as a sacrifice and left to drown, or, if taken by those who were not their close kin, eaten. That the villagers at home had given up their lost kin was indeed a cause for shame, for the dead can have kinship with the living only as memories, and those who returned from the dead in their own persons confronted their co-villagers with their denial of kinship, their readiness to give them up as sacrifice. How could they do otherwise than weep and sink their chins to their chests in shame? A person adopts the bodily posture that indicates shame, shyness, embarrassment in a ritualized situation in which he or she is the focus of or referred to in ceremonial speeches. And children have ample opportunity to learn what is expected of them in terms of comportment. In any given ceremony, this form of bodily comportment demonstrates a polite self-deprecation and humility in the face of public attention. The shame that was evinced by the villagers in the face of their kin returned from the dead was, however, qualitatively another matter. Its very intensity of expression was an aspect of villagers' awe, their recognition of mana as an, in this case, miraculous efficacy, divine or ancestral. The occasion was unique. It had no precedent. Nevertheless, the response of villagers in the face of their returning kin was prefigured in the lived history of Fijian social relations, Vakavewekani, according to kinship, Vakabanua, according to the land, Vakaturanga, according to chiefs. It follows that this heretofore amazing, unprecedented event took on willy-nilly the status of a contingency, something that might happen, and in so doing, provided, as it were, for the only proper response. That the five returnees were, in their welcome, effectively accorded a status at the peak of the chiefly hierarchy was because in their own persons, in the sheer fact that they were alive, they evinced mana, the efficacy that is the marker of true chiefs. They were kalawangata, blessed, or, to give a literal translation, their rescue was effected, ngata, by God or the ancestor gods, kalo. Later on that day, I was among the women who crowded into one of the village houses to listen to one of the two rescued women. All of us were quiet, awed by the aura of the miraculous that surrounded her, and to this day, I can see her face in my mind's eye, though I saw her only this one time. I return now to where I began, with the idea of history as it is lived, history as we evince it every day in everything we do and say. The idea is at the base of the unified model of mind, person, and peopled world that I have put forward elsewhere, as follows. Mind is a function of the whole person that is constituted over time in intersubjective relations with others in the environing world. Intersubjectivity is crucial because it provides for those many and manifold relations in which our ideas are perforce further differentiated by virtue of accommodating to the meanings that others have made and are making. Here, historical continuity and transformation are aspects of the self-same process. The unified model is intended to provide for an analytical approach to ontogeny that does away, once and for all, with analytical dichotomies between mind and body, individual and society, biology and culture, subject and object, agency and structure, and so on. The awareness that these dichotomies are problematic, analytically speaking, has been observed over and over again by philosophers whose ideas inform my discussion here. I cannot claim that the model I put forward is original in respect of any of its components, but I do claim that their synthesis offers anthropologists a way to analyze and compare history as it is lived in the ideas and practices of people across the globe, including, of course, ourselves. I argue that in order to understand ourselves better, we can study the ontogeny of ideas such as culture, biology, the individual, society, and so on. That is to say, their cognitive constitution by living persons throughout the course of life, over time. To do so, we have only to realize that these ideas are not given in the nature of things, but just like mana or shame, they warrant research. Let us take culture, for example. What is the process through which children constitute the idea that culture is a material something they have? How do they come to know that biology and culture are held to be separate domains of explanation? That biology is to be understood as a given, or that culture can be lost or found or recreated? An ethnographic study of the ontogeny of the idea of culture is no more nor less difficult than any other. It entails an historical social analysis of the use of the term in manifold domains of daily life, an analysis founded in long participant observer fieldwork, supplemented by interviews and other qualitative techniques with adults, and a systematic cross-sectional study of children to find out the age at which they begin to use the term and their ideas about what it means at any given point. This aspect of the study has to be systematic because the analyst wants to find out the details of the microhistorical process of the constitution of the idea over time. The process of constituting ideas is one of continuing differentiation in use. In other words, the very process of bringing ideas into being is transformational, even while its more obvious aspect is continuity over time. Such studies enable us to understand how we come to take our fundamental ideas for granted as obvious, given in the nature of things, and how these ideas come to take material form in such a way as to have a purchase on the world that is utterly compelling for us. Insofar as one might want to hold to an idea of historical necessity, it resides precisely in this process of the constitution over time of our ideas of the world and human being. I have to emphasize here that I am not suggesting studies of so-called socialization or enculturation or social or cultural construction, not at all. What I am advocating is the microhistorical study of how children make sense of concepts that adults use to talk about the world and what it is to be human. I have argued elsewhere that the task of the analyst is to render analytical the categories of the people with whom he or she works. This is my method for doing so. I like it because it levels the playing field, as it were, between ourselves as analysts and those whose lives we study. It entails a recognition, firstly, that the inexhaustible world provides for confirmation of any and all human ideas, and secondly, that our own taken for granted ideas and practices warrant ethnographic and microhistorical analysis if we are to understand how they are constituted over time, and in this same process gain that degree of purchase on the world that enables us to assert our own certainties in the face of all the others. Thank you.